Yep, he's planning another project. So this Father's Day at Lowe's, tap into free gifts for dad. Get a free select Craftsman power tool when you buy a Craftsman V20 charger with 2 amp hour and 4 amp hour batteries. Plus, get a free DeWalt power tool when you buy a select 20 volt max XR 4 amp hour battery kit. Dad knows our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 7/14 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Supreme Court. The term already is shaping up to be a whopper when it comes to debating what the court means by what cases it's hearing in oral arguments, what cases it's aiming for in the future, and what cases it's denied. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at the University of Chicago and also at NYU. To comment on a case already presented to the Supreme Court in oral arguments. It is Michael Sackett versus the United States Environmental Protection Agency. This is about the environment. It's about water. It's also about what I'm struck by, the confusion of those of us who are not legally trained, that's me, reading what comes to the court in strange language. Here it is. Petitioners Michael and Chantel Sackett own a vacant lot in a mostly built-out residential subdivision near Priest Lake, Idaho. The lot has no surface water connection to any body of water. In April 2007, with local permits in hand, the Sacketts began building a family home. But later that year, the EPA sent them an administrative compliance order determining that their home construction violated the Clean Water Act because their lot contains wetlands that qualify as regulated, quote, navigable waters. I stop there because there's precedent here, but the professor will help us understand how wetlands are navigable when you can't sail a boat on them. Richard, a very good evening to you. I have a stream on farmland I'm very familiar with because I'm sitting on it. The stream clearly is not navigable, but the fish do very well in it, and it tumbles down to the Housatonic River. That means the EPA is right to protect it. But a wetland, Richard, that's when it rains too much or when there's a seasonal stream. There's nothing navigable about it if you arrive on a sunny day. So please help me understand what the EPA's thinking is and where this case is going. Good evening to you.
All right. Well, this has a long history. What you did is you mentioned that the first interactions between the government and the Sacketts was in 2007. And so already something is deeply out of whack if it's taking you 15 years to decide a permitting question. What you're talking about is bone-dry land, which, of course, can be inundated by rain. But if that's the definition of a wetland, the United States is one giant wetland. So the definition has become ephemeral. And what they're trying to do is to expand the definitions of a wetland or a navigable river or body of water in order to escape the scope of government authority. And the scheme here is completely ill-designed. The first thing to note is if this thing is a wetland, all the other houses around that are built on wetlands alone. And so why is this night different from other nights? Why are they treating him in this way? There's no really good answer. The argument is supposed that something could happen here that would influence something on a navigable water. And there was a case very on called the Riverview Bayview Homes, in which the Supreme Court, in deference to the scope of the powers of Congress, said they can call a navigable water any uplands which somehow or other is interactive with a navigable water on the grounds that one directly affects another. That may make sense, not that I think it does, if it turns out there's some observable movement that's taking place between the two bodies. But in this circumstances, there's absolutely none. And so what you're going to try to do is to say, well, what is the effect in this particular case? And this is the way in which I would want to say this, is that there's no way in hell that they should be able to stop somebody from building on a plot of land. And indeed, in the first Sackett case, what happened is the Supreme Court, with some amazement and some reluctance, said, you know, if what you're going to do is to threaten somebody with a $35,000 a day fine for building something in violation of one of our edicts, nobody in his right mind could ever challenge what's going on in this case. And so they struck it down. So the correct way to do this is to put the government to the test. What we do is we say, hey, There are two ways that you can deal with this thing. One is you can actually show that there's some interaction. How do you do that? What you do is you get some dye, you inject it in the soil somewhere on the land of the Sackets, and then wait to see whether or not that marker shows up in any navigable body of water. You're going to have to wait, I fear, a very, very long time. So what happens is I don't think that physically you could show the connection, but somehow or other nobody even argued about this on either side of the case. And the second thing that you can do is when something actually does happen, you can bring an action for public nuisance, that is mischievous behavior on private land that adversely affects public land. So if it turns out the Sackets start to build something and they create some kind of fixture on their land, say to store water or oil, and this thing leaks into the river, you can sue them and enjoin that particular behavior so as to protect the body of the world. That's not a very new knowledge. This is a principle which has been in effect now for close to 500 years, going way back to early English time. So you could do that. Then, of course, what you could also say is, look, we don't want to have to prove a nuisance. We don't like anything. What we should do is we'll condemn the land. And that way we can have it to our heart's content. And what happened is this was tried once in a case on the beach in Lucas in the South Carolina, in which eventually they did this. And what they say is, look, you really think this is a danger? Buy the land from us. Pay us $100,000. And then what happened in Lucas is what would exactly happen here. The government has paid $100,000 to buy a plot of land on which it doesn't can't do anything with it. So what they immediately do is they sell it to somebody else and allow them to build, subject to certain kinds of restriction. Those are the ways in which you ought to think about this. But to think that this is a case in which you really have to advance the purposes of the Environmental Protection Act by giving government maximum power ignores the problem. So Judge Kahanji Jackson, what GOC says is, well, this is inconsistent with the general mandate of the EPA to protect the nation's water. No, it's not. And the mandate to protect the water doesn't simply say everything has to be done by regulation. It says sometimes it can be done by condemnation. And the question is, if you extend the mandate this far, it turns out that what you're engaging in is wildly overclaiming by the government. To put it to you in the bluntest term, Johns, suppose you were to ask the government how much it would pay in order to stop the Sackets from building on their house if they had to pay the money and they had a limited budget. Do you think they would want to spend $100,000 taking a bone drive lamp and keeping it idle? Or would they spend the money trying to keep the rivers clean and prevent direct pollution from taking place? This is a massive distortion of sensible policy. It's just a sign of how far environmental movement has gone to the point where it's non-destruction. The simple kind of rule is treat this as if it were a parallel to a private dispute. If a private person who owned that river could not enjoin the Sackets from building their house, neither should the government.
I'm speaking with Richard Epstein about a case that's been presented to the Supreme Court in oral argument, and now we turn to one that is ahead of us to be presented in oral argument in this term. The case is Moore v. Harper. It involves the authority of a state legislature to set terms for elections within that state. In this case, I believe it's the state of North Carolina. But really, it applies to any state that over these last tormented years have been called into question because it's adjusted the state voting rights at the time of the pandemic. Richard, the question here is going to come again and again. And I see the court wants to hear this, but what they're trying to determine is who's to regulate the state legislature. Is that the federal government? Because that clearly is not my understanding of what the Constitution designed.
Well, let me first of all read you the clause and then show you what I think is a profound ambiguity in it. It says the time, place, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. They don't mention the courts in any way, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except for the place for choosing senators. Why that last exception? Because remember, the senators were chosen by the state legislatures. They were not chosen in 1789 by popular election. Well, the first thing when I read this clause, I looked at it, I said redistricting is not a way of holding an election. It's something there and the states would have exclusive powers over it. The standard reading is very much to the contrary of what I think to be the correct meaning. And it says that Congress could always override it. So they haven't overridden it here. So the question is, what does it mean by the legislature? And the argument is these state legislatures are bound by state constitution. One of the interesting things, of course, in 1787 is the exact nature of this override was highly unclear because the state constitutions themselves were sort of very ambiguous. And so the issue is there some kind of constraints that the judiciary can put on the process? North Carolina shows how this can go very awry very quickly. The North Carolina basically did an election for redistricting, and they botched the job up in some sense. Why is that? Because the Supreme Court, in a case called RUCO, followed the advice or the opinion of Justice Roberts, who said when it comes to the configuration of these various districts, the federal government and the Equal Protection Clause has nothing whatsoever to say about it. And so the moment that this is done, the state legislatures, both red and blue, work full time to create distortive maps to maximize the influence of their own party. And they did this. The North Carolina Supreme Court looks at it and they say, you know, this is wholly corrupt. And so they want to stop it. The question then is, what can they do under their own constitution? What they said is, we're going to reject this map. We're going to give you time to put another map up, but it's not going to be enough time. Then we'll reject your second map. And then by the time they're done, they say, we'll impose the map. And so what we do by the time you go through the process, it says that the time, place, and manner of holding elections shall be determined by the state Supreme Court overriding the legislature. That can't be right. And so to some extent, the position that is taken about the aggressive intervention can't be there. So my view is that you probably are going to have some overrides in cases where people would not want to override it anyhow. You had, for example, a state legislature which says we're going to determine exactly how these things are going to be set, and we're going to exclude all black people from it. I think an equal protection clause violation would be there. But what's happened is state constitutions are infinitely pliable. And if you go back to the last time in 2020, when Pennsylvania did exactly this and overrode it, it relied on its fair election laws. And its fair election laws allowed it to do whatever it wanted, including to make very specific judgments as to when late ballots ought to be counted and not. I thought that was just a wholly abusive kind of behavior by their part. And what happens is if you take the view that the state legislature is constrained fully by the state constitution, that means the state judges who are not going to be reviewable on this question by the federal court can put the zaniest rules in effect and completely negate what's going on. So I think what you really have to do, and the Supreme Court has to face it, is place very strict limitations on what's going on. I think they have to review all the past cases in which this particular power has been asserted and come up with a conclusion of the few cases in which this is appropriate. But in most cases, it turns out that it is not. What I really think has to be done is to completely change the way in which we do districts. And New York State's very instructive in that. They also had a situation where the state legislature went bonkers. It turned out even the New York State Court of Appeals wouldn't allow that to happen. And then there was the appointment of a special master who actually drew a very decent map, and the legislature and the courts did not overturn it. And so what you really need to do under these circumstances is to develop a system in which the state, in my view, using race-neutral terms and so forth, goes for compact districts and those which are similarly manageable, delegates the thing out to a commission, does it in ample time to allow for review, and then has the power up or down to either accept or to reject that particular map. If it's not an up or down power, you'll never get things concluded. And the New York map turned out to be a pretty good map. And so I think that's the way in which one has to go, which means that you just can't simply argue this debate solely within the framework of Article 1, Section 4, dealing with the power to organize these elections. You have to have more fundamental institutional arrangements. The political talk saying that, you know, the end of democracy is nigh, that's true no matter which way you come out on this particular case, because there are abuses both in red and in blue states. And what you have to do is to recognize that Chief Justice Roberts was wrong when he said the organization of a state system of district is something that's a political thicket to which we will not enter. If you don't enter it as the court, at least in some responsible way, outrageous things are going to happen, not only in North Carolina, but throughout the entire land.
We've been speaking of cases before the Supreme Court, either has already been argued orally or will be soon. When we come back, cases that were turned aside by this court that will not be heard, and therefore the lower court, the appeals court, stands. This is CBS Eye on the World with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.